This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And for some of you, this day might not be as pleasant as it is for the rest of us, because you're coughing, you're sneezing, you're wheezing, your nose is running because you have seasonal allergies, and spring can be a miserable time of year for you. Well, Dr. Ali Swabany is a naturopathic doctor. Her medical school training included a focus on what are referred to as natural treatments for symptoms and causes of illness and disease. She's joined us on Main Street before to talk about differences and similarities between naturopathic and traditional medical doctors, and for a discussion on bacteria, sanitizers, and antibiotics. Today, she joins Ashley Thornburg to talk about seasonal allergies.
Dr. Swabany, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This might not be an easy question. What causes allergies?
From a naturopathic perspective, I'm always looking at symptoms from the underlying cause point of view. And so the last time we talked some about the gut microbiome and the bacteria that live in the digestive tract and in various places in the body, and disruptions there can certainly contribute to seasonal allergies.
Okay. What are some of the more common seasonal allergies?
A lot of seasonal allergies to the various pollens that bloom in the springtime. I have a lot of patients who came in this spring with some problems with the snow mold that was present after the melting. It was particularly bad this year, and so that's been causing people some problems. And a lot of people have some fall allergies too, especially when the harvest happens. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all the farms in the area, people will get seasonal allergies from that. And certainly there are people where that seasonal allergy becomes more chronic, where they're dealing with symptoms all throughout the summer, and then they start to have sinus problems throughout the winter months too. So it can become chronic, and that's an issue.
What are some symptoms we should be looking for with allergies, especially because, you know, coming off of winter, it can mimic cold symptoms?
Yeah.
When does it become symptoms of an allergy?
Yeah, good question. So I would say the symptoms differ to some extent. When we're looking at an allergy, we're looking at the runny nose, runny, itchy eyes, itchy ears, sneezing. Some people get more rashes and hives, more skin-type symptoms, and then they can feel that post-nasal drip at the back of their throat. And it can go as far as to produce headache and fatigue and some of those things we might get with the common cold. I think generally, people recognize it as allergies when it's a bit more ongoing throughout the season. So we don't have this short burst of perhaps a spike in fever and some of these symptoms come up and then it dissipates after a week. We have this ongoing process happening in the body.
Sure. Yeah. Is it possible to treat the symptoms of the allergy and neglect the possible underlying causes?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's probably what's most commonly done in conventional medicine. So a lot of the common allergy medicines we see on the market will potentially relieve the symptoms. You know, Claritin, some people will do Benadryl. Those will alleviate the symptoms in most people temporarily. Mm-hmm. The challenge with that is that without treating that underlying cause, we're probably going to have those symptoms pop up the next season. And often it's worse over time. So I have a lot of patients who come in and say, you know, they're 40 years old, I've never had allergies before. And now all of a sudden I have allergies. Mm. And that's where I go into that underlying cause piece of the puzzle.
When you say something like all of the sudden, and I think there's this implication here that by all of the sudden, we mean we're finally being forced to pay attention.
Yeah.
and maybe missed subtler body cues along the way. What are there some more subtle things we can maybe be looking at?
Yeah, that's a really good question, too. So, some of those like early signs that we might be developing allergies. One of the things I've heard really commonly is problems with the eyes. So people will go to their eye doctor and the doctor will say, well, you've got allergies in your eyes. You've got like an allergic response happening in your eyes. And really what they're experiencing is just a little dryness. So I think sometimes just simple dry skin, dry eyes can be an early sign that something is awry in the immune system and allergies could potentially be on the horizon. Mm-hmm. I also think just some of the milder symptoms like, oh, I just get this little kind of gunkiness or drip at the back of my throat, mm-hmm. you know, this time of year. It's no big deal. I can deal with it. That's what people will say. And then the next year it's a little worse and the next year it's a little worse. So that's really the time to start addressing it.
Okay. When it is subtle.
When it's subtle like that. Yeah. It's easier to treat then.
Yeah. Well, we have this attitude, I think, especially in the Midwest too, that like there is just a steeliness. And yeah, there's a suck it up. Niff. Like if stick-to-itiveness, if there was a word for that, for suck-it-up-to-itiveness, that's... Mm-hmm. what are the numbers of allergies? Like, have you seen an increase or a decrease in the time just that you've been paying attention anyway?
I don't know that there's been an increase in the time that I've been, you know, in practice. But I think it's pretty clear from the statistics that allergies have increased tremendously just in the past couple decades. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of potential causes for that. But I know from the work that I do that there's a lot of immune disruptors out there that people aren't necessarily paying close enough attention to.
And what are those?
So we know that there are a lot of toxins in our environment that some people are paying closer attention to than others, and those certainly disrupt the function of the immune system. A lot of the poor dietary choices we might make affect the health of our digestive tract, and about 75% of the immune system lives in the digestive tract, and so there's a disruption naturally that would happen there when the digestive system isn't processing properly.
Okay. So we should maybe think of our bodies a little bit like cars. You want a good oil change every once in a while.
Yes. Okay. Yes, absolutely. And the maintenance piece I like of that analogy as well.
So we're not going to put in oils. What do we want in the – well, I mean, there are some good oils. But I mean, not car oil. What are some of those – like what's the human equivalent of an oil change for food, for allergies?
So I like a lot of, you know, I think it's become kind of popular in the media, but one of the things that I really like for this type of thing is bone broth. Okay. So bone broth is a really, you know, especially a homemade bone broth or a really good one that's on the market is something that is going to coat the digestive tract and help to heal any disruption that's perhaps happened there. All the foods that we have that improve the digestive flora, like fermented foods, sauerkraut, kefir, yogurt.
Kombucha.
Kombucha. Okay. Yeah, so popular now. Kimchi.
Does wine count?
Wine? I'm not going to count. I'm not going to count wine. I don't think there's a lot of...
There's always a catch.
Yeah, there is always a catch. Yeah, so those things are going to help. And then, you know, just one of the old... naturopathic treatments that we sometimes will suggest for people that's quite simple is local honey. Local honey is actually because of the it's a reminder to the immune system about local antigens or allergens that might be present, and so it helps your immune system become primed and sort of create a more balanced response to the allergens in the environment.
Okay.
So yeah. So local is key.
Okay. So like taking a
raw local
plant zone 9 and trying to plant it in zone 4, it's just not going to work well.
Mm-hmm.
And we should maybe think of ourselves that way too.
Yeah.
When is it time to see, like we're attacking this from a naturopathic perspective. Are there cases where you, a naturopathic doctor, Dr. Swabany, would recommend that someone goes on to a more severe or the more conventional Western traditions?
In regards to allergies?
In regards to allergies.
Yeah. So the place where I really think of conventional medicine being absolutely necessary in regards to allergies is more of a it's less often an environmental allergen, although that can be the case, and more often a food allergen where we have we get the anaphylactic reaction. So there's
those are deadly quickly.
Right. So, you know, I would absolutely recommend having the EpiPen available, having all of the conventional treatments, you know, available if you have in your history responded with anaphylactic reactions to any allergens.
Okay. Can we talk about the cost of EpiPens?
We can. It's not my area of expertise, but I know that the cost has gone up tremendously.
Very high. I mean, we're talking triple digit percentage increases here.
Mm-hmm.
What
is one to do?
Yeah.
I don't have a good answer for that, Ashley. You know, in the next segment that I was preparing to talk to you about, I was thinking about, you know, the systemic changes that need to happen in medicine. So that's a big kind of can of worms. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think that question about the EpiPen is much bigger than we have room on this segment to talk about.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, perhaps we can get a roundtable discussion on the cost of things like EpiPens on another day. But going back to Western medicine approaches, and we were talking about anaphylaxis, and that is definitely a time when you are going to need more than, for example, sauerkraut.
Mm-hmm.
What about, like, testing for allergies? Because obviously you don't want to be discovering that you have an anaphylactic response to something like a pecan when, you know, you're not
right
near an EpiPen. So do you recommend people get tested for allergies?
The truth is, by the time people end up in my office, generally they've been tested with blood work by their medical doctor if there's risk of some of those more severe anaphylactic reactions.
Okay.
So actually, no, I often don't test. I often just, you know, they present in my office with the symptoms of allergies.
Mm-hmm.
I do what I call functional testing, which is determining what's functioning and what's not functioning on the underlying level in their systems, in their organs, and then I treat from that perspective, right? So if I do some functional testing and see their immune system looks disrupted and they're also presenting with allergies, then we're going to really focus in on the immune system. I might see that their liver also looks like it's not functioning optimally from a functional point of view. So maybe we'll add in some treatment for the liver as well, and that's kind of how we work with it in the naturopathic sense.
Okay. When you say there might be some testing for people who might be at a higher risk for allergies, so like in terms of breast cancer, there might be a gene.
Right.
And then obviously you look to the family hereditary issue.
Yes.
What are risk factors of allergies?
Certainly the family history is a huge risk factor. We know that young children, I mean, I think it's quite common for parents and doctors to be looking out for young children whose parents and family members have those severe allergic reactions. And then, of course, there are children who come up with severe anaphylactic responses whose family doesn't seem to have that in their in their genes. So, yeah, there are ways to test it in the blood, and you can go into testing various parts of the immune system. And so they would do that in the lab.
Do you see a correlation at all? I have heard people who have seen a rise in the increase in elective C-sections. And obviously C-sections sometimes are very necessary and save a lot of lives. And sometimes they're an elective procedure. And some in the more natural type medicine argue that elective C-sections can correspond to the sort of immune responses that we're seeing, or a decrease in immune responses, I should say. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, I think the evidence shows there is truth to that. So we know that a child coming through the vaginal canal, being born in the natural way, does help them develop their natural microflora.
Why?
Right. Why? Well, the vaginal canal is packed with flora. I mean, just from a scientific standpoint, we test group B strep in every pregnant woman to ensure that the child doesn't pick that up coming through the birth canal. So that's when they would give antibiotics during the birth process. So we're very aware in some ways and using that information to prevent particular illnesses. So it would make sense, right, that the child picks up other types of bacteria as it comes through the birth canal. Okay. We also know that the child gets a lot of protection from breastfeeding, and that's pretty well known at this point, but certainly so many of those immune factors that we need to accumulate early in our lives to prevent allergies and chronic disease in the long term come from breastfeeding.
Dr. Swabany, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ashley.
That was our Ashley Thornburg talking with Dr. Ali Swabany, who is with Prairie Naturopathic Doctors in Moorhead. Coming up on Main Street, essays from Tom Ezern and Chuck Lura.
I'm also worried that if I make it out, that's like every time you make it out okay, that's like further down the road you go, thinking that you're always going to make it out okay.
Tune in for Diary of a Bad Year, a war correspondent's dilemma. From NPR's Kelly McEvers and me, Jay Allison, for Transom.org. Presented by PRX in collaboration with NPR.
Diary of a Bad Year, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at NDSU and a prolific writer who shares some of his work with us in the form of Plainsfolk essays. Today, his essay is about a former guest on Main Street named Rebecca Bender. Her family's story is unique, and like Tom, she wrote it down to share with others. Here's Tom Ezern's essay, titled, Still.
If you're like me, you've already filled up your calendar with events and expeditions for the summer. Make room for one more. 2 p.m. Sunday afternoon, June the 9th. Rebecca Bender will book talk her recent work, Still, at the Wild Rose Bar and Cafe in Ashley. Why not make it a day in McIntosh County on the eastern front of German-Russian country? There will be time before or after the book talk to make pilgrimage to the Ashley Jewish Homesteaders Cemetery just north of town, where you can connect with the pioneering folk who are the subject of Rebecca's book. I'd say get into the Wild Rose in time for its excellent Sunday buffet, then take in the book talk, and then caravan out to the cemetery. If we're lucky, the meadowlarks and the kingbirds will sing to the sun for us. Rebecca Bender is a daughter of the Jewish homesteading colony in McIntosh County, of which not a soul remains in residence physically. Many folks that hereabouts will tell you the Jews didn't really know how to farm. They were not suited to the country, and so they cleared out pretty quickly, which is poppycock. Fact is, most homesteaders of any faith or culture stayed only a little while until being bought out by neighbors. Those who left, some of them had failed as farmers, but most of them left because they had succeeded, had proved up and profited, then sold out on a rising settlement land market and moved on to do what they really wanted to do in life. This appears to be exactly what happened with the Jews of McIntosh County, with the added impetus that certain ceremonies of the faith required the participation of a requisite number of male adherents, making it hard to maintain community on the sparsely populated plains. Rebecca's folks hailed from Hoffnungstal, also known as Zebrikov, by way of Odessa. There, in the outposts of Russian Empire, the Jews suffered not only institutional oppression, but also horrific violence, pogroms that ripped through the community, killing thousands. And yet, in the words of the Jewish Am Olan movement for survival and resilience, in the waves of life under heaven, many more will be erased, But us, a grieving nation, will live forever, and God's light will shine for eternity. The next station for that eternal light would be McIntosh County, where Jewish immigrant homesteaders clustered and took up farming in the first decade of the 20th century. They forged good relationships with their German-Russian neighbors, relationships born of mutual assistance and ordinary commerce. In time, Rebecca's folk, having done well, bought a store in Eureka, South Dakota, and did well there also, for themselves and for the community. Kenneth Bender became a war hero, fighting the Nazis. You have to read his memories of leading his men to battle with dog tags bearing the H insignia for Hebrew, knowing such would mark them for summary execution if captured. And you want to meet his daughter Rebecca, an attorney who has led the way in preservation of the cemetery and commemoration of the Jewish pioneers. Her book, Still, she'll explain the title to you, is published by North Dakota State University Press.
That's Tom Ezern. Next, another regular Main Street contributor, Chuck Lura, with a Natural North Dakota essay titled Custer Mines.
I recently heard someone openly wonder what was with all those hills along Highway 83 near the turnoff to Garrison. No doubt many North Dakotans have passed that way and may ask the same question. Those hills are old mine spoils. A coal mine was in operation there from the 1940s to the 1960s. Keep in mind that this was before reclamation laws. Now, of course, the overburden must be replaced and landscaped. As you drive past the area on Highway 83 or on Highway 37 towards Garrison, you can almost imagine the drag lines digging down to the coal and piling the overburden in adjacent piles, slowly moving eastward or westward across the landscape, then moving perhaps southward to repeat the process. What was left was basically linear piles of overburden after the coal had been extracted. Over the years, the Garrison Sportsmen's Club, along with various groups of adults and kids, planted an estimated 150,000 to 200,000 trees in the area, ranging from cedars and pines to chokecherry. Volunteer trees have also made the place home. Then in the late 1980s, Consolidated Coal, the owner of the mine, turned over almost 700 acres of property to the North Dakota Game and Fish Department. The area is now known as Custer Mine Wildlife Management Area. The area has undergone considerable development over the years, and now is a popular area for enjoying nature. There's always a chance of seeing some white-tailed deer, red fox or coyote, and a wide variety of birds ranging from pheasants and partridge to warblers and owls. The 4-acre Custer Mine Pond is stocked with trout, and, of course, also provides the opportunity to see waterfowl and shorebirds, and perhaps a mink or raccoon. To make the area more accessible and interesting for the public, hiking trails have been developed in the area, along with an interpretive kiosk. The entrance and parking lot to the property is located just west of the Highway 8337 intersection. So the next time you travel that part of the state, if you can, allow for a little extra time to stop in and take a closer look at the area, and maybe go for a hike or do some fishing. There's much to see, learn, and enjoy there. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botno. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, Senator John Hovind talks about efforts to negotiate an end to the trade war with China. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The University of Jamestown will be building a new residence complex. The construction of UJ Place begins in July. The plan is to open in the fall of 2020.
With the number of events up in the northeast part of town, with Harold Newman Arena's addition and hockey, the high school, and track, there's just a hub of activity up there, and this is just a great opportunity to serve our students and the community as well.
University of Jamestown President Dr. Dr. Polly Peterson says the five-story building will help address the growing student population while also bringing business and opportunity to the northeast part of Jamestown.
The University of Jamestown's growth in undergraduate enrollment has sort of driven our need for additional housing, particularly in the area of transitional housing, where students have an opportunity to still feel like they're residing on campus, but actually have an opportunity to be in an apartment style where there's a little more independence.
Peterson says the building will round out and highlight the east side entrance to the campus as well. A new concern in higher education is using technology to cheat. Russ Pauline is a senior director for policy, analysis, and strategic alliances for a division of Western Interstate Compact for Higher Education. He says there are corporations who are trying to lure students into cheating.
They pretend that they're the institution and say, we will sell you exams, or we'll sell you papers or these sorts of things. And they pretend they're the institution. The students think that it's endorsed by the institution, but it actually is cheating.
Pauline says working on that particular problem is one of the top priorities for WICHE this year. And Ducks Unlimited has hired Ryan Taylor as its public policy director for North Dakota, South Dakota, and Montana. Taylor is a former state senator and Democratic candidate for governor. He had also served as state director for USDA Rural Development. He will be based in Bismarck. Taylor says because of his background as a farmer and rancher, he can help bridge any gap between agriculture and conservation.
And a lot of us in agriculture, we grew up loving to hunt and loving, you know, what our farms and ranches provided besides, you know, grazing land and cropland. We were there for the ducks and the grouse and the geese and the deer and the fur bears and everything else. So I think we can get there for sure.
Taylor says he thinks Ducks Unlimited has been doing a good job in conservation and in working with farmers. He says he hopes to improve on that. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by North Dakota U.S. Senator John Hoeven. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. And, Senator, thanks for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Doug.
Let's talk about the trade negotiations between China and the United States. How would you assess the current status of those talks?
Well, you know, ongoing. Obviously, we're anxious to get them concluded, and we'd hoped a week before last that we were going to get an agreement in principle. So at this point, I feel like the Chinese are delaying. And I believe what they're delaying over is some of the enforcement mechanisms, which would prevent them from stealing our technology and infringing on patents and copyrights and trademark and those intellectual property. And so I think that's been the holdup right now, but we're anxious to try to get them to a completion.
The president initiated this issue last July. We're about 10 months into this now. If you were to, you know, make a wager, do you think we're out of this reasonably soon, or we're in for the long haul?
Well, I hope we can get to agreement sooner versus later. It's very important, particularly for our farmers who are out there on the front lines. And right now, I'm hopeful that perhaps in June at the G20 meeting when President Xi and President Trump meet, that they could get to an agreement in principle. I think that's the next window for trying to get an agreement.
There seems to be some savvy in terms of the Chinese position on this, because they seem to be purposefully targeting soybean farmers.
No question about it that they're targeting our farmers. They know that that's a pressure point, and that's why I worked to get the first market facilitation payment, and that's why I'm working on a second round. We had hoped to have an agreement, like I say, a couple weeks ago, but now that the Chinese are delaying, I've really pressed the point with the White House and USDA that we need a second round of assistance to keep our farmers going, because no question that China has targeted them in this trade negotiation.
Well, you serve on the United States Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry, and that includes talking about trade, obviously. And there's been some confusing rhetoric around the word tariff here from the White House and from other people as well. For our listeners, describe what a tariff is and who pays it.
Well, tariff is a tax on goods that are imported into a country, and who pays it is a function of both the producer and the consumer, and it really comes down to, you know, who's able to pass the cost on. So in some cases, producers pay the cost depending on the competitive environment and other factors. In other cases, they're able to pass it on to the business or the consumer that imports the product.
Well, the president has said that billions of dollars are pouring into the U.S. Treasury. Those billions of dollars are coming from people who are importing goods from China, aren't they?
Well, that's it. It's from both. I mean, it, in some cases, the exporter is forced to, you know, cover the cost in his product if he's not able to increase his price. In other cases, as you say, it's paid by the importing entity or ultimately the consumer.
So you've been pushing for more financial assistance to farmers, and I assume the funds that would be distributed that way would come from this tariff revenue, correct?
That's it. I mean, last year I think the tariff, it was about $40 billion came in tariffs last year. This year, already year to date, it's about at that number, and obviously it's going higher. So there's significant funding coming from the tariff. So the market facilitation payment, you know, is using some of that tariff to offset the impact, the direct impact on our farmers.
But that tariff as a tax is essentially a tax that is returned to some farmers, correct?
Well, it is, and you have to remember that our farmers produce the lowest cost, highest quality food supply in the world. So every single American benefits every single day from that high quality food supply at the lowest cost, and that's why it's so important that we have good farm policy, because it's not just about benefiting our farmers and ranchers. It benefits every American every day.
But don't we have kind of a triple whammy here? First of all, we've got soybeans that are in storage because the tariff was imposed before the crop was harvested. Now we're preparing to plant another harvest. So there's that. There's a supply of soybeans, maybe an overabundance. There's a strong dollar, which makes it a little harder to move it out of the U.S., or a little more expensive. And now there's a tariff. So that's a
Absolute,
lot of burden.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's why our farmers are under a lot of pressure, and that's why we have to assist them to get through this negotiation. Look, the solution is not tariffs. We don't want tariffs. We want fair trade. We want open trade. We want free trade. That's what we have to have. No one produces food, like I say, better at higher quality, lower cost than our farmers. What we need is the ability to sell our commodities, not only here in the United States, but globally. And that's what we have to have. From our standpoint, what we want is open markets, free and fair trade. We don't want tariffs. And that's why it's so important that we get access to these markets and force other countries like China, which China, you know, sells an incredible amount of product into our market. And at the same time, they totally trade on an unfair basis. They not only steal our technology, infringe on our copyrights, patents, and intellectual property, all those things, they also have incredible trade barriers that prevent us from exporting product into their market. And that's why it's so important we try to, you know, that we force them to play or trade on a fair basis.
Well, we've been talking about soybeans principally so far, but there are other crops, wheat, corn, and canola. Would there be some support for them as well?
Yeah, and you know, that's what I'm working on. In other words, last time it was primarily focused on soybeans, to a lesser extent wheat, and then corn got some assistance too. This time, in addition to a market facilitation payment, what we've been working on is also perhaps purchases and then also some trade assistance to try to open up some other markets and to get some assistance to some of these other crops that are feeling the impact as well. So that's what we're working with USDA to try to do.
Now, since the imposition of these tariffs and this tit-for-tat between China and the U.S., both of them raising these tariffs on goods that are being imported and exported, China appears to be working very hard to develop new sources for some crops, particularly soybeans. Are you concerned about the long-term impact of that?
I am. Obviously, they're buying soybeans now from Argentina and Brazil. And we've worked very hard in North Dakota, and particularly North Dakota. I mean, I think our farmers and ranchers do such an amazing job. And it's not just growing the crops. It's all the things we've done to develop markets like China. We've got identity preserved, all the work we've done in terms of transportation, which includes containerized transportation, which means not only rail but also the shipping customers and having identity preserved all the way to the customers, all these things that have been built up over time, and we ship an incredibly high product, but our people have had to work to build that. So I am worried about that, and again, that's why every time I talk about trade, whether it's with the administration or USDA or you on the phone, we need to push to get this to completion. Ultimately, we need those markets.
Is the president receptive to what you're saying?
Well, he is, but he's also determined to get China to trade on a fair basis. You know, they have been taking advantage of us, and he feels it's a problem we have to solve. And I think the country feels it's a problem we have to solve. And so it's very difficult in the short run, but that is why when I visit with him, and I visit with him again just a little over a week ago and said, look, our farmers are going to need more assistance because the Chinese are delaying.
Were you surprised by the president's decision last July to impose these tariffs or to get this going the way it has?
I don't know if I was surprised. I recognize that we need to deal with China and their tariffs. I would like to see us do more to get some of our other trading partners on board in pushing back on China and creating more pressure to get them to stop what they're doing. I don't, not just the United States. There are a lot of countries around the world that recognize what China's doing is absolutely unfair and needs to change.
Should the president, though, have conferred with Congress before doing this?
Well, I think he has conferred with Congress. Obviously, being a member of the Senate, I always want to the president working with us. And you just saw that. A good example of that is on USMCA. You saw it where he just recently dropped the tariffs on steel and aluminum. That's very helpful because now both Canada and Mexico have dropped their tariffs. Well, for North Dakota, they're our number one export market because, you know, a lot of our oil goes up through Canada, even though ultimately it's routed back into the United States. But we export a lot of product to Canada and a lot of product to Mexico. So that will help us. But we've got to get the House. So a very good step by the administration to drop the tariffs. Now both Canada and Mexico have dropped the tariffs. But we've got to get the House to move on that new trade agreement, the USMCA, United States, Canada, and Mexico trade agreement. But it's got to start in the House. So we've got to get the House to take it up. I mean, that's how it works under the law. But I'm very anxious to get that treaty moved.
Well, you mentioned steel and aluminum and the Mexico and Canadian connection there. That affects, of course, the price of farm implements, and we've already
exactly.
got a difficult farm economy. So what's the ripple effect here?
That helps us. I mean, that helps us because of all the steel that's used in ag products. We have, for example, in North Dakota, we have grain bin manufacturers who import steel from Canada for building grain bins. That's just one example. But so those small manufacturers have felt real pressure on that too, as well as it raising the price or cost for our farmers. So it's very helpful. And this new agreement's a good agreement. We've got provisions in there, some of the things I worked on along with others, but we're able to get changes in there that will help our farmers. For example, right now when we send grain to Canada, it gets downgraded right away. Under this new treaty, Canada can't do that.
Would you have preferred a different negotiating strategy over tariffs? You know, we're 10 months into this now. There are other ways than just imposing tariffs. You've talked about the trade imbalance and the difficulties we've had with intellectual property issues, copyright and patent and all that. But is there another course that might have worked better?
Well, ultimately, we don't want tariffs. The key is that, you know, however we do this, we get not only China, but we're working on Japan, the EU, and others. Ultimately, the goal is less tariffs. It's tough no matter how you do it. I mean, I don't know how you get China to change. You know, it's a totalitarian government. So I think we always knew no matter how we approached it with China, it was going to be tough to get them to change. There's no question. But ultimately, the objective is to reduce tariffs and eliminate them wherever possible.
Recently, there's been some rhetoric around the position, the president's position, and the support for it or lack of support in our country. And the farmers who've been affected by this have sort of been characterized as patriots, which puts them in a kind of a difficult spot, don't you think?
I think, you know, our farmers, number one, as I mentioned earlier, an incredible job, and I think they recognize ultimately they need access to these markets. And so I think they recognize that we've got to try to get countries like China, Japan, and others, EU, others, to change. But it is tough for them. And so, yeah, they're hanging in there, but, you know, this is their livelihood, so we've got to find ways to help them. And that's why I've worked very hard, not only on the last round of assistance, but on this round of assistance, because it is very difficult for them.
But farmers are failing in some cases. Bankruptcies are up. And is it patriotic to just lose your farm?
Well, of course not. The thing, you know, for the really well-established farmer, they have the ability to hang in there, even though it's tough for them. But obviously, the biggest concern is for our younger farmers and those that are more leveraged. And that's why, again, working to provide that assistance is vital.
We import about $540 billion in goods each year from China. They import about $120 billion from us. And this is a really important trade relationship for both countries. There is talk about the potential for decoupling, finding permanent replacements for these supply chain elements that are currently intertwining our economies. Is that a reason for concern?
You're talking about between us and China?
Yes.
Well, I'll give you an example. Matter of fact, I was visiting with administration officials on it today. You know, with the whole 5G network system, and, you know, China produces so much of the electronics, and you saw recently Huawei, the company that produces a lot of those components.
Yes.
You know, we've restricted Huawei from providing those components to anything that would be sensitive in terms of our integrated systems and as we develop the 5G. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of how these trade relationships and as you say, product distribution networks develop, we have to be careful, because in the tech world, when you're talking about communications, when you're talking about control systems for power companies and dams and all those kind of things, you know, we have to be very aware of how all those electronics work so that we don't put ourselves in a situation where we have any kind of national security risk because of components that are produced in a totalitarian country like China, that could potentially be compromised. So, you know, this is obviously, this has incredible ramifications in terms of product distribution and so forth as we develop the new technologies.
Well, and as I look at my Apple Watch and my Apple phone, they're made in China, and the potential might be that this disruption would mean eventually they move someplace.
Well, that's what I mean. You're going to see changes already. That's what you saw with the executive order in regard to Huawei and the other actions that the administration and Congress has taken, because we have to be careful as these technologies develop, internet and everything else, so that we know they're secure.
Who would benefit most from a really firm agreement with China to protect intellectual property rights? Because obviously the patent holders in the U.S. or the copyright people in the U.S. are the ones who feel cheated here. But the reality is this goes to China, they mass produce something, then they sell it back to us at a discount.
Right. That's exactly right. And it even goes into these security concerns like you and I are just talking about. I mean, it's our whole economy. I mean, you look across industry sectors. I mean, it's not just the high-tech sector. It's energy. It runs the gamut of, you know, I mean, again, America is the country that leads the world in innovation and entrepreneurship. And so to not be able to protect our technology and our innovation and our developments affects our entire economy.
But that would mean that everything that we buy that uses that technology would go up significantly in price. And for just to talk
about... Not necessarily.
Well,
no.
In a few months when we're Christmas shopping and some people are...
I'm saying ultimately with fair trade and free markets, no, it wouldn't. I think everybody would benefit. I mean, I think that is the solution. If you're talking about tariffs in the near term, yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't follow. You're saying, do tariffs affect our costs? Yeah, that's why we don't want tariffs.
So what I'm getting at is that it's possible around Christmas people are walking into Walmart, which is an outlet for an awful lot of Chinese goods. They're going to see significant increases in the cost.
They could, depending on how much that cost increase can be passed along, but we'll see. Again, that's what we talked about earlier.
Are you bullish on this quick ending, or are we in for another? Will we be talking about this next year?
Well, I hope not. I mean, obviously, as I said, Doug, earlier, I'd like to get to agreement sooner rather than later. So, obviously, I'm pushing to get it to conclusion as soon as we can, and I'm hopeful, but I'm going to keep working at it. It's hard for me to make predictions.
Okay. Well, if you were to characterize the relationship between Congress and specifically your Senate committee and the White House in terms of coming to an agreement on strategy and all that, are you there?
Well, what I can tell you is I work on it every day trying to get solutions, and like you just saw with USMCA. But we need to get other people engaged and working with us once we get these agreements to pass them. So we need the House to get moving on USMCA. Let's get the things done that we can get done and keep trying to push the negotiations to get completed as soon as possible.
Well, we're almost...
And not just with China, with Japan and with some of these other countries too.
Sure. We're almost a year into this now, and a couple of weeks ago, China announced tariff hikes on U.S. products, they were following our imposition. So is there another step in increases that's likely before this is figured out?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not going to try to get into the prediction business here, Doug. What I will tell you, though, is China backed up. I mean, they had come around. We were close to an agreement in principle, and they backed up on it. So, again, I think we are pushing very hard, and I'm hopeful that they'll come back and would really like to see them do something around that G20. Like I say, I think that's the next opportunity where we might see some kind of agreement. But, again, I'm going to be careful about predicting and just continue to do what I can, and that's to push to get resolution as soon as we can.
Who holds the better hand here? I mean, China is an authoritarian regime. We are a democratic one. People voice their opinions here. President Xi can tell people to do what they want to do, can't he?
Yeah, you almost put your finger on it in posing the question, Doug. I think you kind of almost answered it as well. If you look at our respective economies, our overall economy. We've talked about how tough it is for our farmers, but our overall economy is doing much better than China's economy. So in that respect, you'd have to say, well, we have the upper hand, and we have to take some steps like we've talked about to help our farmers and so forth where we're particularly impacted. But overall, our economy is doing much better than theirs. On the flip side, they're a totalitarian regime, and they think in terms of hundreds of years when they do things.
Yes.
And so that's what we're competing with. But we also have to recognize that's why it's so important we stand up to them.
All right. So they look at things from the long view, and we look in two-year election cycles typically.
Well, exactly. Yeah, well, right.
Okay. Right. Well, Senator, we really appreciate you spending some time with our listeners today. This is an important issue for North Dakota, and I know it's an important one to you. Senator John Hovind.
It absolutely is. Absolutely.
North Dakota U.S. Senator John Hovind, thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Dakota Date Book is next.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll spend the full half hour with Frank Larson, the founder of Starion Bank. We'll talk about the book written by Pat McCloskey from the University of Mary about Frank, called Frank's Extra Mile, A Gentleman's Story, next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Date Book for May 21st. On this date in 1918, Leo Horst appeared before the North Dakota Council of Defense in Fargo. Horst was accused of sedition for statements made in Towner. Horst was said to be pro-German and disloyal to the United States. Horst submitted proof that while his parents were of German descent, he was born in Hagerstown, Maryland. As proof that he was not disloyal, he presented evidence that he had attempted to enlist in the Army on numerous occasions. He had also presented himself to the draft board twice. On each occasion, he was turned away because of his poor eyesight. As part of his defense, Horst read portions of the speech made in Towner. He had talked about a trip to the Twin Cities, during which he noticed piles of goods beside the tracks. He learned that speculators had held food in boxcars in order to drive up the price, but when the railroad needed the cars, the food was simply dumped on the ground where it rotted. He said it was un-American for scoundrels, thieves, and robbers to take advantage of the war to make money while young men sacrificed everything on the battlefield. The portions of the speech he read differed significantly from statements attributed to him in the newspapers. Horst was a well-known nonpartisan league organizer, and the charges appeared to be politically motivated. Horst's defenders said his enemies had trumped up the charges. They noted that the allegations against Horst were reported on the front page of newspapers with blaring headlines, but the grand jury's dismissal of the charges only received small headlines on interior pages. The nonpartisan leader accused a secret backroom club in Fargo of trying Horst in the press. After the charges were dropped, Horst again tried to enlist. This time, the Army accepted him as a recruit. He was quickly promoted to sergeant and served as an instructor throughout the rest of the war. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Doctors are battling infections that drugs can't cure.
We are getting to the point where there are organisms that are resistant to every known antibiotic.
Now they have new allies, paralyzed veterans who volunteered as test subjects.
Just the fact that the research is going on gives us hope.
The war against superbugs on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
There are many ways to listen to Prairie Public. We've got mobile apps, streaming via our handsome new website, prairiepublic.org, which just got a makeover. Through smart speakers like the Amazon Echo, just enable the skill and ask you know who to play NPR or Prairie Public. And are we forgetting something? Oh yeah, you can listen to Prairie Public across the state of North Dakota on a good old-fashioned radio. That's right, it's just like when you discover that the music you like listening to is now considered classic rock. Yeah, it kind of hurts. Radio, still kicking it after all these years.
Wednesday on Main Street, we'll talk with author Paul Starr, a Pulitzer Prize winner for nonfiction, a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, and a co-founder of the American Prospect magazine. We'll discuss Starr's latest book, Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.